Aaron tilted his head back. Lyssa was above them, ghostly in a rich blue sky. His mother's moon. Tantera would be along with the dark, pulling the water with her, battling Lyssa for her father's affection. For Joha was the aspect of sea and sky, and the water remembered. Had his mother known who his father was, he wondered. Was she complicit in his crimes, or was she deceived? And in the end, did it matter? Perhaps, he thought, it only affected him if he let it. His parents' choices were not his responsibility, and he didn't need to atone for decisions he had no hand in making. His mother, like his father, was as distant and remote as the moon for which she'd been named. On some level, he'd always be drawn to them, but they had no real power to change his course. He'd get the Ember Blade back. Not to make up for his father's treachery, or to impress Garrick, but because it was the right thing to do. "Is that it?" said Cade. He was pointing off to port, where a narrow opening was half visible in the darkness between two projecting rocks. "It may be," said Vika. "Grub, bring us closer." Grub muttered something in Skarl as he hauled on the oars and steered them towards the opening. They had to duck as they entered, for the ceiling was low enough to hit their heads. But once inside, they saw that the passageway headed on into darkness. It was chilly and dank beneath the rock, and cold water dripped on them. Cade lit a lantern and held it up. Grub took the oars from the rowlocks, handed one to Aaron, and they used them as poles, pushing against the sides of the passageway to propel the boat along. It was an awkward job in the crowded space, but the cave was too narrow to row. They left the light of the afternoon behind. Glistening stone closed in, pressing down on them, and noises echoed eerily. Ruck whined and flattened her ears against her head. Aaron was pleased when the passageway branched. It matched the map of the caves, which Cade was holding. Cade directed them left. The ceiling got higher, or the water got lower, and soon they could sit up straight again, and everyone felt better. Aaron took them down another turn, reassured that they were making progress. There'd be another junction ahead, according to the map. Except there wasn't. There was only a wall of stone, blank and impassable. Aaron and Grub pulled them to a halt. "Did I miss a turn?" Cade wondered. "There shouldn't be a blockage here," said Aaron, puzzled. He'd been following the map with Cade, and there had been no mistake. "The map is very old," said Fenn.
"Not as old as that rock is," Cade said testily.
"Dumbfaced navigate like a drunk cow," Grub opined.
"He's reading it aright," said Aaron, "as am I." He peered more closely at the map, trying to see if there was some mark, some clue he'd missed, but this was the only way through. If they couldn't pass, then they'd fall at the first hurdle, and the whole plan would lie in ruins. They'd placed their trust in him and his ideas. Failure here would crush him. Then Vika chuckled.
"Peace," she said. "We are early, that is all. The water is still too high."
Aaron groaned in relief. Yes, she was surely right. The ceiling ahead was below the level of the water. They'd simply have to wait. Wait they did, in the chill tomb of the waterway, as the black water lapped at the stone, each wave visibly lower than the last. It was dropping fast. Aaron dreaded the moment when that downward creep would be reversed, when each little wave would be higher than the one before it, rising up to claim the caves once more. To pass the time, they speculated on how Orica, Harrod, and Mara were faring. Orica had been hired on the spot, as they'd expected, and they'd left Harrod and Mara in the safe house, getting dressed up in clothes befitting guests of the Crodan Empire. Yet though their companions were entering by the front gate, they faced dangers every bit as real as those in the boat. How much had Kiel told the Iron Hand? Did they have names and descriptions? Was Mara's invitation reliable? If they were caught or refused entry, Aaron and the others would never know. He became aware of an irritating drumming noise,
Cade's fingers on the gunwale of the boat.
"Ain't hardly the breathless charge into peril I was imagining," Cade said, as inch by inch the cave ahead was revealed.
At last they sank to a level where they could move forward by ducking down and pushing themselves along the ceiling with their hands. After a few uncomfortable minutes, the ceiling lifted again. The passage widened out into a cave, and the light of the lantern barely reached the walls. They began to joke among themselves, feeling more cheerful now they were not so confined. Then they heard something splash in the dark, something that sounded larger than a fish, and they quieted again.
"The way through should be just over there," Cade said, pointing.
"Grab feel more like rowing now," the skull said. He took up the oars in haste and put his back into it, scanning the waters to either side as they went.
Lantern light played over the wall of the cave, brightening it steadily as they approached. It took Aaron only a moment to find the mouth of the next passage, right where the map said it should be. As they got closer, he saw there was something inside it, throwing the light back wetly. He squinted to see, and when he realized what it was, his heart sank. Bars. Vertical bars, set firm into the rock a short distance along the passage, with a gate allowing access. Grubb brought them up to the gate, and they pulled the boat in against it. The metal was rusted but sturdy, and a huge iron lock held the gate closed. Aaron gave it an experimental tug, but it didn't move.
"Let Grubb see. Grubb can pick any lock," said Grubb, clambering towards the front of the boat, while the others fought to stop it from tipping.
He muscled Ruck aside and peered into the keyhole, then sat back and thought for a moment.
"Grubb can't pick that lock," he announced firmly.
Cade let out a sigh of exasperation.
"One day we really ought to talk about your overconfidence."
"It rusted solid," Grubb protested. "Nobody put a key in it for 100 years. Cade can't pick a lock if the parts don't move."
"This gate's not on the map," Aaron said, as if by pointing that out he might make it go away.
"I told you, the map's old," said Fenn. "Someone put this in since it was drawn."
Aaron threw her an angry glance. She was being sullen as a defense against nerves, but it didn't make her unhelpfulness any easier to swallow.
"If I may,"
said Vika, who was squashed behind Grubb. She pushed past, and Grubb reluctantly moved aside. He began working his way back from the prow, threatening to tip them again.
"Don't know what painted lady can do that Grubb can't," he muttered. "She going to pray it open?"
Ruck snarled at him, and he aimed the back of his hand at her before thinking better of it. Vika studied the lock for a time while Aaron chewed his lip, his confidence eroding. Another unforeseen problem, and they'd barely started. How many more were waiting? He'd been a fool to imagine this would go like clockwork, with so many uncertainties involved. Perhaps it was best if they were turned back now, before they got themselves killed. Wilhelm might have been right to call his plan a naive fantasy. Vika reached into her patchwork coat, pulled out a file, and emptied it over the top of the lock. It contained some kind of thick, glutinous liquid. She replaced the file, took out another, and unstoppered it.
"Push us away from the gate when I say," she said. "Do it gently, so I do not fall."
She poured the contents of the second file onto the first.
"Now."
They pushed away, Fenn steadying Vika, and the boat slid backwards in the water. They watched the lock. Nothing happened. Cade, as usual, was the first to state the obvious. "Nothing's happening," he was interrupted by a sharp hiss from the gate, growing louder, till it was like a nest of snakes. A wisp of smoke rose from the lock, and then a tiny, furious white glow squirmed out of nowhere, growing in size and intensity, until it was blindingly bright. Aaron had to shade his eyes and look away until the noise and light faded again, leaving a smell of sulphur and tin.
"Now," said Vika, "let us try again."
They paddled closer. The passage was murky with a thin, toxic-smelling mist which obscured Aaron's view until they were very close. When they bumped up against the gate, he was amazed to see that the lock had melted into a thick black sludge, shot through with specks of glowing red. "Push," she urged them, "before it hardens." They pushed. The metal groaned and the lock stretched and pulled apart, but still the gate didn't give. They tried again, but the harder they pushed, the more the boat wanted to move away from the gate. Then Fenn had the idea of propping the oars against the tunnel wall to brace them. They shoved once more, and this time the gate screeched open, suddenly enough that Vika had to grab Cade to stop him falling in.
"Yes, Grab knew he'd get through. He is unstoppable," the Skull cried.
They laughed, and Aaron grinned at the sight, ashamed of his doubts. Who says Ossians can't work together? Vika caught his eye. "How much sweeter the victory when it is shared, hm?" she said quietly. He smiled at her. "I'm really glad you're back, Vika." "I would not be anywhere else," she said. "Now, onward, and may the aspects go with us." "Aspects go with you." Her words triggered a hint of a memory, which bothered Aaron as they passed through the gate. The rough passageway was quickly becoming wider and higher as the water lowered, and he let Cade navigate as he tried to remember when he'd heard those words last. Finally it came to him. "Vika," he said.
"Aye?"
"Just after you woke, when Garrick said his farewells and set off with Keel, you realized something, didn't you? I remember seeing it on your face. Did you suspect Keel then?"
"Keel?"
she said. "No. No, I am sorry to say I had no idea about him. It was Garrick who concerned me."
"Why?"
She weighed her words, her face thoughtful. "When he said farewell, and I could be mistaken, Aaron, though I am not often, when he said farewell, I believe he knew it was the last time he would ever see us. He did not intend to come back. I heard it in his voice."
"But how could he bring us the Ember Blade if he didn't mean to return?"
"That I do not know," she said. Then she shook it off. "It matters not, Aaron. Our task is unchanged." But her dismissal was too brusque to be convincing. The news settled uneasily on Aaron, and the dark seemed a little darker after that. At length, they neared the tunnel promised by the map, the waterway built in days gone by to link this network of caves to the caves underneath Hammerholt. They'd emerged from the passageways into a large cavern, and as they rounded a bulge of stone, they found the tunnel entrance before them. Cade sat up a little straighter, raising his lantern.
"Nine," he breathed. "Now ain't that a sight to see?"
The mouth of the tunnel was wide enough for five of their boats, and was flanked by two thick pillars cut from the mountain rock, their surfaces carved with huge leering faces, cavorting figures and strange beasts. The centuries had worn the detail from them, but they still possessed an unsettling primal savagery, and the faces, heavy of jaw and brow, small-eyed, subtly inhuman, unnerved them all. The massive lintel overhead bore an inscription, still visible after all this time, but the message held in those stark, jagged runes was a mystery to them.
"Urds," said Vika in a low voice. "Once they were the masters of Ossia, over the earth and under it."
Grubb studied the pillars as they slid past. "Grubb think they're not as ugly as the new lot."
Cade snorted with laughter. The tunnel was a wide square channel, walled with immense mould-streaked bricks and supported by more pillars and lintels along its length. Glaring faces loomed and receded to either side, craggy and shadowed. Some were urds, brutish and fierce, but others were more monstrous, with huge teeth and bulging eyes. They wore necklaces of ears, or sported manes made of swords. Aaron sensed the malevolence of old gods here, angry at being robbed of their might, and it made him feel small.
Do not fear, said Vika, responding to his unspoken thought. They cannot hurt us now.
They can if they decide to stop holding up that roof, said Cade.
The tunnel was long and seemed longer, but at last they rode out into another cave, higher than it was wide, its upper reaches in darkness. Before them was a metal ladder fixed to the cave wall, rising to a ledge overhead. Running alongside it was a vertical mooring pole.
"Can you see a door?" Aaron asked, craning.
Cade raised his lantern high, but the projecting ledge obscured his view.
"Reckon we need to go up there and look," he said.
They tied the boat to the pole, leaving the knot loose enough that it would slide up as the water rose. Then they clambered out one by one, except for Vika, who stayed with Ruck. Cade was first up the ladder, climbing awkwardly with the lantern in one hand and Aaron close behind him. The ledge was broad and naturally formed, and there they found the door, as promised. The two of them exchanged a grin. It was a relief just to have got this far. Even this small success encouraged them. They examined the door. It was narrow and low, made of metal, and it looked thick. Aaron doubted even Vika's concoction could burn through it, assuming she had any left. There was no lock on their side, but a crank extended from the centre, lying flat against the door. Aaron tried to turn it downwards and then up, but no matter how he pulled or pushed, it would only move a fraction. Something was barring it on the other side, as they'd feared. By this time Fenn and Grubb had got up the ladder. Grubb insisted on trying himself with no better luck. Aaron looked over the ledge to Vika and Ruck.
"Are you coming?"
"The tide has turned, I think," Vika said, her particoloured face eerily bright against the dark mass of her coat. "I will wait for the water to lift us higher. Easier than carrying Ruck."
Aaron stood back and looked around at the others. He was eager to act, to move on, but the next step was out of his hands. He didn't like that feeling.
"I suppose we must wait then," he said. "Let us hope our friends in the fortress are successful."
"That or better learn to breathe water," said Grubb grimly.
Fenn hugged herself and gazed into the dark. Cade noticed and forced a jovial tone.
"Oi, does anyone know the story of how Halleck Stormfist fought his way through the hordes of the Revenant King and slew him in single combat?"
"It rings a bell," said Aaron wryly, "though the version I heard was about a Croden warrior called Hocke storming the castle of the Lich Lord."
Cade cackled.
"I reckon you'll like this version better."
His face came alive in the lantern light as he turned his attention to his audience, and the performance began.
So, there was Halleck, alone, having lost all his faithful companions on the trek across the plains of poison fire. All his companions but one, which he was never without. A sword that glowed red as molten rock as the dawn sun struck it. An unbreakable weapon, sharp as time's teeth. The Ember Blade, they called it. And he carried it with him into the lair of his greatest enemy, the Herald of the Outsiders, the Revenant King himself.
They listened, eager for distraction, as Cade told his tale. Below them the water lapped hungrily against the stone, creeping higher with every little wave.
85. "I'm late, I'm late, I'm late."
Orica tapped her foot nervously against the floor of the cart, her lute, safe in its case, clutched to her side. Sards, like Ossians, were not generally concerned with punctuality, but tonight was an exception. The troop and their instruments were crowded into two carts, roofed with canvas but open at the sides. Towering before them was another massive gatehouse, the third they'd encountered. At each there had been queues, checks and searches, driving both Orica and their harried leader to distraction. Delays, 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 and with every wasted moment the water in the caves rose higher. The road through the mountains was clogged with traffic by the time they reached it. Guests and their retinues jostled with merchants delivering last-minute supplies and teams of soldiers borrowed from the Morganholm garrison. They'd seen signs of the Iron Hand, too, an outsized black wagon with huge wheels, the double-barred cross emblazoned on its flanks. Its contents were a mystery, but Orica felt the cold touch of dread as it passed, which didn't lift until it was gone. Soon the road had narrowed, passing between two shoulders of rock topped by squat guard towers, and they'd been funneled into the shadow of Hammerholt. Some of the musicians gasped at the scale of it as it sprawled up the slope where the mountains met, a forest of square towers penned behind tiered walls that rose steep and angular against the evening sky. Once inside, their pace had slowed even further. The best organization in the world couldn't cope with so many people arriving at once, and the fortress was designed to repel rather than welcome. They inched along walled corridors intended to hamper invaders, beneath rows of murder holes through which arrows could be fired and boiling oil could be poured. At last, they'd reached the final obstacle, the gatehouse that gave access to the inner fortress, where the night's festivities would be held. Already the 11th bell a day had sounded. She had less than 2 hours left, more like 1.5 by now. They were scheduled to perform at 12th bell, providing half an hour of entertainment before the guests headed to their feasts. There'd be a break before the post-dinner performances, which was the perfect moment to slip away. But if they started late, or if the proceedings went on too long... Surely not. These were Crodans, the most diligent timekeepers in Embria.
"Don't worry," said Olin.
He was an elderly bitterbracker who played the idra, a traditional Ossian ramskin drum.
"Nobles or peasants, an audience is an audience, eh?"
Orica looked down at her tapping foot, stilled it, and gave Olin a smile of gratitude. He'd misunderstood the source of her agitation. She could play for the aspects themselves and not worry, but it was kind of him. A few of the others were visibly displeased to have a sard among them, but most, like Olin, treated her like anyone else, and the harpist eyed her with obvious lust. Musicians were travellers, always on the move, and less apt to hold the cosy prejudices enjoyed by small-town folk who were never exposed to any but their own sort. Edgan was the leader of the troupe, a fractious middle-aged Rhinelander with a flowing moustache and a mane of glossy black hair that he played with constantly. He was speaking to a gate guard, trying to keep his temper, as he ran through the same answer he'd given at the last two gatehouses. Crodan soldiers passed up and down the carts, eyeing Orica with particular suspicion. She kept her gaze on the floor of the cart and said nothing. She wished Harrod were here. It was a new feeling, this sense of need. She was bereft without him, and that thought didn't make her comfortable. She'd always been independent, even for a sard, who prized freedom higher than most. How quickly she'd become accustomed to Harrod's tall, solid presence at her side. How easily she trusted him to guard her, when once she'd guarded herself. How absurd that she was jealous of Mara for being on his arm tonight. The ragged mama liked her tricks, but it was Sebastra, aspect of love and beauty, who made fools of them all, and the two of them loved to work together. At first, she'd thought Harrod a strange fish, but she knew the ways of Harrow, and she was impressed by his awkward declaration of loyalty the night she played at his father's court. For the Harish, who considered showing emotion to be the mark of an unschooled serf, it was madly romantic, impossibly gallant. Of course, she'd refused, for he was already betrothed, and she wanted to save him from himself. But he'd persisted, and when she left for Ossia, he'd followed, catching her up on the road. By then he'd already spoken with his betrothed and destroyed himself in the eyes of his family and peers. She talked with him long enough to ensure he understood her circumstances and that the most she could offer was friendship. He was undeterred, so she accepted him. It wasn't the sard way to reject willing company. She knew he burned with love for her, but he was ever chaste, polite, and restrained, and after some time together she came to trust that he'd never act on his love, or even speak of it, unless she invited him to. And she couldn't help being flattered by the force of his attention. Sard passions burned bright, and were rarely hidden, but this was of a different order, a level of sacrifice she'd never expected. He was a good and admirable man who'd fallen for her at first sight, and given up everything for her. It was hard not to be a little intoxicated by that. How slowly Sebastra worked her art, and how the ragged mama must have laughed behind her hand. As their friendship deepened, Orica began to see the man beyond that wall of Harish Reserve. She found kindness, a passion for justice, unexpected warmth and humour. She came to admire his morals and his discipline, and to understand what he'd done when he turned his back on his family. To follow your heart was the ultimate rebellion in Harrow. But he'd chosen dishonour rather than to betray his, even with no hope of reward. He was so different to any man she'd loved before, so far from what she thought she wanted, that she didn't recognise what was happening until it was too late to avert the heartbreak that had to follow. They were together, yet they could never be together, not as lovers should be. The risk was far too great. It was well known that Sards were forbidden to bed anyone other than a Sard, but only they knew the real reason why.
"Get on with you, then."
The voice stirred her from her thoughts. The gate guard was done with Edgan, and the first cart was moving through. A soldier slapped the side of Orica's cart, and they jerked into motion, rattling under the arch into a crowded courtyard where a dozen other carts were being unloaded. No sooner had they stopped than they were spotted by an angry man in fine velvets and a bearskin cloak, who came hurrying over.
"Edgan, by the Primus, where have you been?"
The master of revels was a red-faced, bespectacled man, with a white moustache and mutton-chop whiskers, wearing a rabbit fur hat to cover his bald pate. He'd evidently had a long day, and what patience he possessed had been used up some time ago.
"My deepest apologies," Edgan said. "We set off early, but we shed a wheel on the way, and—" "Get your people ready. I want you tuning up in the West Gallery in 10 minutes.
Do you—" He stopped as he noticed Orica's bright green eyes.
"Is that a Sard?"
Edgan paled. "Medilla fell ill, and this is her replacement. I had no other choice. I assure you, she is an exquisite musician."
"Tovan's blood! I don't care how she plays. She's—"
The master closed his eyes and pressed his fingers to his temples, where the veins were beginning to throb.
"No matter. It's too late to switch you around. For your sake, you'd better hope the prince doesn't take exception to having a Sard in his presence."
"The prince?" Edgan squeaked.
"I promised him the best Ossian musicians to play the finest songs of the land he is soon to rule. That would be you, at least I thought it was."
"She is from Ossia," Edgan said weakly, but the master's glare warned him to go no further. "Don't disappoint me," the master said venomously, and clicked his fingers at a servant who was hovering nearby.
"Take them to the West Gallery," he said, and then he was off, shouting at someone else.
"You heard him," said Edgan, hurrying to the rear of the cart. 10 minutes.
He gave Orica a barbed look, as if it was her fault he'd been snapped at. Orica said nothing, just as she'd said nothing to the master of revels. Once she'd played in the highest courts of Harrow for the king himself and been treated as an honoured guest. There were few Sards in Harrow, and they were not numerous enough to be despised. Unlike here, where she was talked down to, sneered at or discussed as if she wasn't there. Yet she'd swallow their insults, as she always had. She'd keep her mouth shut and her head down, and she'd fight for her land. Because whatever they said, she was Ossian, and this was her home.
"Prince Otico," Olin was saying excitedly as he gathered up his drum, "we're playing for the prince."
"No," thought Orica, as she stepped down from the cart with the lute under her arm. "We're playing for my friends' lives."
86.
The great hall of Hammerholt echoed with hundreds of voices speaking in a dozen languages. Harrod and Mara, having been shown in moments before, stood at the edge of the sea of faces and looked out over the remarkable gathering before them. Crowded together beneath the towering stone arches were representatives of many countries, from Embria and beyond, even as far as Caragua in the uttermost west. Here were black-skinned Zulans, elegant as water. Red Helicans from the arid south, painted and pierced. Desert-dwelling Boscans like beetles inside their rigid hoods. Carthanians, richly clad and raucous. Tall Trinish from the mountain forests. Lunish, arguing as ever. Shangi, calm as always. Drab grey Galts. Ossian nobles, haughty Harish, sober Crodans, and more besides from all across the lands. They'd come to witness a historic union, the joining of the two most powerful forces on the continent, and to jockey for position in the new future ahead. "There are some here that shall know me," said Harrod, showing none of the unease Mara knew he felt. "They will know of my disgrace." Mara looked at him. He was dressed in a green velvet jacket, dark purple hose, and soft doe-skin boots they'd picked up on Chandri Lane. A short cloak covered one shoulder, pinned there with a silver brooch in the shape of a Draken Segent, the emblem of Harrow. She'd hardly seen him out of his armour until yesterday, and the clothes of his homeland suited him well. "Knowing they will not speak to thee," she said. She spoke in Harish, as did he. "And they will not dare to question thy presence. So let them gossip among themselves. They can do us no harm." She held up her arm for him to take. "Let us find our quarry." He took her arm, and they made their way into the crowd, where they were offered wine. Harrod refused, but Mara accepted a glass. It was a Carthanian white, dry and woody and delicate. She savoured it while she listened to the 16-piece orchestra playing at the far end of the hall, smoothing the tempest of conversation with the sweet harmony of strings. The Carthanians might make the best wine, only Amberline was comparable, but the Crodans made the best music. Nothing equalled the mathematical grace of the Crodan maestros. Shrill, breathless laughter caught her ear as two fair-haired Trinish children darted through the crowd, a brother and sister chasing one another, drawing scowls and indulgent chuckles. They passed Mara and were gone. The joy of their game brought a smile to Mara's lips for a moment, but it faded fast as blissful imaginings gave way to cold reality. The children she longed for were someone else's, as was the man she might have had them with. That had been her choice. She'd seen children as the end of life, not the beginning. She'd believed that to be a wife and mother would be to submit to the Crodan way, to forfeit her power and independence. After that, there was only the slow decline into domesticity, giving up the extraordinary for the mundane. Would that have really been her fate? She didn't know. But she'd been younger then, fiercer, more certain of things. So she'd refused Danric his dearest wish, and it had broken them, and he found another. To the end of her days, she'd never be sure if she'd had a lucky escape or made a colossal mistake, but in moments like this, she knew which one it felt like. A terrible thought struck her. She saw a flash in her mind, a roar like thunder, fire billowing through the doorways. Children screaming, wounded, burned, dead. Little girls, just like those she'd once taught. She'd known there might be children in Hammerholt when Garrick had outlined his plan, but it had been easy to dismiss it then, when she couldn't see their faces. Easy to say they were a necessary sacrifice, when she hadn't heard them laugh. Danric had never liked the way she could wall off her heart with logic, separate herself from her feelings with facts. But it was a skill that only went so far. She could never wall herself off from him. "Peace," she told herself. "Garrick's plan will not come to pass now. Nobody will die." It hadn't seemed necessary to tell Aaron and the others about Garrick's plan to destroy Hammerholt with barrels of Ellerite oil. Let them keep believing he was trying to steal the Ember Blade. Aaron had impressed her with his mind and his character, but he was still idealistic, not ready to see Garrick as he truly was. If they managed to rescue him, Garrick might well lead them again, and it would only harm the cause if they knew the truth. She didn't know where the barrels were now, whether they'd been delivered or not, but it hardly mattered. They had a new plan, which Mara and Aaron had cooked up between them. It was best to let sleeping dogs lie. "The Iron Hand," Harrod muttered, directing her attention to two black-uniformed men standing together at the edge of the room. One was short and balding, with spectacles and a somewhat froggy look about him. The other was stern, blonde and handsome in a Croden sort of way. "They are on their guard," Mara said. "They suspect something, perhaps." "Garrick cannot have talked, or we would have been arrested at the gate." "Likely thou art right. Certain the security has been no stricter than we expected. Perhaps the Crodans imagine the danger is over now that Garrick is in irons." She watched as the men scanned the room. "I do not think those two share that view." Mara kept an eye on them until they left, the taller one limping as he went. Their presence made her tense. It was a reminder that torture and death awaited them if they failed. "There he is," said Harrod, "the Master of Keys." He wasn't hard to recognize from his description. The Master of Keys was imposing in size, broad-shouldered and big-bellied. His face was soft and jowly, and a roll of flesh sat between his chin and his collarbone. His jacket was stitched with the crossed keys of his office, and he wore a golden medallion on a heavy chain around his neck. "We should introduce ourselves," said Mara. Before they could do so, the orchestra stopped, and a bell rang for attention. Conversation petered out as all eyes turned to the servant with the bell. "Honoured guests," he called, "it is my pleasure to inform you that performances of traditional Ossian folk music are about to begin in the West Gallery, the Blue Room and Stoker's Hall. Please consult your programmes and make your way to your assigned rooms. Otherwise, you are welcome to stay and enjoy yourselves here. Thank you for your attention." There was a general murmuring as the guests found the printed papers they'd been given upon arrival, each one a schedule dictating where they were supposed to be and when, personalised according to their importance. "Leave it to the Crodans to throw a party and then organise the guests to within an inch of their lives," Mara muttered. Even for her, an orderly woman by nature, this was taking things a little far. "It is not dissimilar to how we do it in Harrow," said Harrod, puzzled at the scorn in her tone. "How else is one to control so many people without inviting chaos?" "This land could use a little chaos," said Mara. "Come." She headed off across the hall. "The Blue Room is that way," said Harrod, looking up from his schedule and pointing in the opposite direction. "We're not going to the Blue Room." Harrod had to hurry to catch her up. The crowd was beginning to thin out as the guests drifted to their designated rooms. Mara kept her eye on the Master of Keys. He was the target. Schedules be damned. They were carried after him on a tide of excited chatter and exotic perfumes down stone corridors where servants waited to guide them onwards. Soon they came to a long chamber set with dozens of portraits on one wall. Tapestries hung on the other, showing parables from the Acts of Thomas and Toven in the Crodan's distinctive geometric style. Seats had been laid out in rows for the guests. The Master of Keys had already taken his place when they entered, and the seats around him were filled, preventing them from getting close. They were shown to seats several rows behind him by an usher, and they had to be content with that. "Yonder is Prince Otico," said Harrod, as they made their way along the row. Mara, not so tall as Harrod, took a moment to find him. He was sitting at the front, his head turned to the side as he joked with a neighbour about something. She recognised him from his portraits, though the artists had flattered him, making him look more regal than was true. In life he was dough-faced, with long sideburns and a wispy moustache on his upper lip.
He had the milky look of one who'd been spoiled and indulged so long that they knew no other way. "He will soon rule this land," Mara thought, "but he will not have the Ember Blade when he does." A bell began to toll in the heights as they seated themselves. Mara didn't need to wait for it to finish to know the count. Last bell a day. Outside, the sun was slipping behind the mountains, and in the deeps below Hammerholt, the water was climbing the cave walls, black and freezing. "After the performance has begun, if thou canst do so without drawing attention, excuse thyself," said Mara quietly in Harish. "Feign that thou art ill, if necessary, and find the door. I shall attend to the Master of Keys." Harod nodded, and they settled in their seats. For the first time, they looked at the stage and the musicians assembled there. Harod stiffened. Mara had no need to ask why. There, hidden at the back, was Orica. 87. Quietly, relentlessly, the water stole higher. Vika watched it with flat eyes over the side of the boat. Beneath the broken glimmers thrown back from Cade's lantern, it was utterly black, an abyss rising inch by inch to claim them. "Is this how it will end?" she thought to herself, "with all consumed by darkness?" She thought of Agali, so warm and wise. In Vika's mind, she was sitting owlishly by a campfire, her hands clasped round a steaming wooden mug, a knowing half-smile on her face. "You will find us a champion," she'd said. And perhaps Vika had, or perhaps she'd misread the signs and they'd all die here. Perhaps the only voice she'd ever heard was her own, and the gods she'd met merely the conjurings of a damaged mind. Ruk lifted her head and whined, sensing her mistress's doubts. The boat had almost reached the stone ledge where the others waited in grim silence. Even Cade's good cheer had faltered in the pressing dark as the chill set in. Now they watched the door and each other, the passing of time measured by soft drips from the ceiling. "The water will be around your ankles soon," said Vika. "Come back to the boat." "Should it be rising this fast?" Cade asked. "What if Mara got her calculations wrong?" Aaron stirred. "I don't think she ever gets her calculations wrong." "She was working off a 200-year-old map and a bunch of moon charts," Cade argued. "Even she would have a hard time being accurate with that."
"Door will open," said Grubb. "Bowlhead or tonsils open it. Grubb is very confident."
But Vika heard fear in his voice, fear of a death he wasn't yet ready for. "We have time yet," Vika agreed, though she'd lost all sense of what time it was. One by one they climbed back into the boat. Ruk reluctantly got up and moved to the stern, grumbling low in her throat. When they were all in, Vika passed round a phial. "Drink this," she told them. "A sip each." Grubb sniffed it.
"Booze?" he asked hopefully.
"No, but it will warm your bones deeper and for longer than any liquor can."
"Painted lady hasn't tried witch-tear rum from Scarathun," said Grubb. "Drink that, then roll in fire to cool down."
"Sounds good to me right now," said Cade. When they'd all taken a sip, she did too, and let Ruk lap a little from her cupped hand. Heat spread through her, making her fingers tingle and bringing a flush to her face.
"That ain't bad," said Cade. "Nine. I feel like I should take my coat off."
"You may need it yet," said Vika, thinking of the killing cold of the lake water. She untied the rope that tethered the boat to the mooring pole and cast it free. It would only drag them under when the water rose higher. Slowly they drifted away from the ledge, out into the cavern. She looked up at the ceiling, not far above them now.
"Joha, hold back your waters," she prayed. "Our people will come for us. Give them time."
88. Orica played. It was all she'd ever wanted to do, since she first laid hands on her mother's lute in the warm summer shadows of the communal caravan. Music, like blood, was life to her. Every significant moment in her past was linked to a song. Her earliest memory was her mother humming a lullaby while Orica sat in her lap, drowsy in the warmth of a fire. She remembered the tumbling drums of Hrachnathun playing nearby as she and her first love lost themselves in a twist of blankets beneath an ash tree. The delicate arpeggios of a Trinish lament healed her heart after the same boy rejected her, for nobody told tales of heroic sorrow like the bards of Trine. Then there was the song that was played when her mother remarried, and the one that so impressed her master he said he had no more to teach her, and the song that made Harod fall in love with her. Music surrounded her, shaped her, underpinned her world. When she played, she tuned herself to the key of creation. Yet, as the troupe ran through Edgen's selection of Ossian folk songs, Orica couldn't feel the music. Her mind was elsewhere, with her companions in the cave, and worry gnawed at her. Her fingers knew their places on the fretboard, but she played mechanically, without passion. Few in the audience noticed. An average performance from Orica was still head and shoulders above what most bards could manage. But Edgen scowled at her, because she'd been better in her audition. He scowled more deeply when Orica began the next song at a brisk clip, faster than it ought to be played, forcing the rest of the troupe to follow her tempo. Orica didn't care. The quicker they finished, the quicker she could leave. She glanced at Prince Otico as they launched into their final tune, a jaunty number about women and wine. The songs had been picked for their inoffensiveness. There was nothing about the aspects, for these were the Primus's lands now, and nothing of Jessa Wolfsheart, Ossia's most beloved rebel. It had been a wise decision on Edgen's part, for the prince appeared to be enjoying himself immensely. His foot tapped to the beat of Olin's Idra, and he had a broad smile on his face. If he had an issue with a sard being on stage, it didn't show. Everything was still going well as the troupe drew the last song to a close and the crowd began to applaud. The grin on Edgen's face was one of profound relief as he bowed to the prince, who was applauding loudest of all. "Wonderful!" he cried, and he rose to his feet, forcing everyone to rise with him. "Encore! Play another!" Edgen beamed with delight at the honour. He bowed low and turned back to the troop. "The Mountain Man's Jig!" he cried. "One, two, three!" Orica struck her chord and the pipes began to play, but horror was growing in her heart. Her fellow musicians' smiles were nightmarish rictuses, the tune jarring and discordant to her ear. "He wants more? How many more? How long will he have us play?" Somewhere in the dark, the water was rising. Mara saw their chance when the prince got to his feet. "Now," she said to Harod. Harod had been watching raptly, his eyes fixed on Orica. He shook out of his trance as the audience around him rose, clapping enthusiastically in imitation of Prince Otico. Even those who didn't care for the music were pretending to be impressed. Mara gave Harod a gentle shove to get him moving, and he began to blunder his way along the row, squeezing his large frame between the applauding guests. Then Mara heard the prince call for more, and the troupe struck up another tune. The applause died away, and the audience began to seat themselves again, stripping Harod of his cover before he reached the end of the row. Seeing him leaving, a servant hurried to intercept him. Mara couldn't hear what was said, but the servant's raised hands and urgent muttering didn't bode well. "Let him pass," Mara thought fiercely. It was imperative that they stayed beneath the notice of their hosts, and every moment Harod was delayed drew more eyes towards him. But the servant wouldn't let him pass. Mara saw Harod put his hand on his belly, miming sickness. But the servant only gestured back towards Harod's empty seat, apologetic but insistent. Everybody behind them was watching their quiet argument. People nearby scowled and tutted, distracted by their voices. One of the guards, stationed at the side of the hall, stirred at his post, wondering if he needed to intervene. "Let him pass!" Mara thought again more urgently. She knew what the encore meant. Their already fine margins were narrowing fast, and Orica was still tied up with her performance. Harrod had to get to that door in the sewers. But if any more fuss were made, then some officious attendant would be forced to take him aside and deal with him, reducing his chances of slipping away to nil. In the front row, the prince turned and looked over his shoulder, an irritable frown on his face. The servant saw him and blanched.
"Please, sir, you must," he said, almost begging now.
The guard began to walk over, and Harrod was forced to concede. With one last indignant comment, he made his way back along the row, running the gauntlet of disapproving stares and tuts. He must have been mortified by the ordeal, but his face was rigid, and he didn't so much as blush as he sat down.
"They would not let thee leave?" Mara whispered. "Nay," he said, "the prince considers himself a great patron of the arts, it seems, and believes that to leave in the midst of a performance shows disrespect to the performer. No such disrespect is permitted in his presence."
Mara cursed herself silently. How had she not known that? It wasn't in Yarin's notes, but that was no excuse. She should have researched it herself. It was only a small detail, easily overlooked amid the mass of other information she'd absorbed. But small details could topple empires and cost lives. She thought she'd considered every angle, but she'd missed this one. Now all three of them were trapped in the same hall, and still the music played on, counting out the remainder of their companions' lives, beat by beat by beat. Fenn hunkered down low in the boat. She had no choice. The roof of the cavern was so close she couldn't sit up any longer. Black water below them, hard rock above, the six of them sandwiched in the thinning layer between. Cade's lantern rested on the floor of the boat, casting its light over their frightened faces. There was desperate hope in their eyes, each of them alert for any intervention which could save them, but it was becoming ever clearer that there might not be any salvation, and soon there wouldn't be any air.
"Don't lean on anyone or anything, Fenn. Not no place or person. Elsewise, when they fall, you'll fall with them."
No. She wouldn't let herself believe that. Orica and Harrod and Mara would come through. They had to. Vika was praying to Joha, bent over in a forced bow, her mouth moving and her eyes closed. Ruk huddled beside her. Cade was praying too, but Grubb was becoming panicked, his eyes wild, palms on the ceiling as if he could fend it off. Aaron's hand sought Fenn's and gripped it. She met his gaze. Scared as he was, she found strength there.
"They'll be here," he said.
She loved him a little for that, for making her believe. There was something indomitable in him which wouldn't lie down and die. Sometimes she was amazed by it, amazed by him. She wanted to kiss him, hold him frantically tight, push away the terror of death with passion. But the thought paralyzed her, and she could do nothing but offer a wan smile of thanks.
"Nobody's coming," Grubb muttered.
Then louder,
"Nobody's coming."
His voice became a shriek.
"Grubb not ready to meet the Bone God. Grubb not want to be unremembered. Grubb sorry for what he did. Grubb sorry."
"Pipe down, you noisy bastard,"
Cade snapped angrily, lashing out with his own fear. But Grubb wasn't listening. He tried to get to his feet, but only pressed up against the ceiling, rocking the boat alarmingly.
"Can't stay here. Grubb, swim for it. Swim back to the lake."
"Don't be a mudwit. You'll never make it."
"Grubb can't stay here."
He lurched towards the edge of the boat, pushing Vika aside as he went. The sudden shift in weight tipped them. Fenn gave a scream of surprise as the boat flipped underneath her, and she was plunged into freezing water, soaked to the bone, shocked by the cold of it. Even with Vika's potion warming her, it took her breath away. She flailed, searching desperately for the surface, but the lantern had gone out, and in the darkness she couldn't tell which way was up. Lost in the abyss, clutching to the last moments of life, one last thought broke through her panic.
"Da, you were right. I should have listened. You were right."
Harrod's attempt to leave the hall hadn't escaped Orica's attention. She knew his posture so well, she could identify him at any distance. She felt the thrill of contact as she saw him, the illicit shock of two saboteurs crossing paths. Until that moment, she hadn't known he was in the room. She watched as he argued with the servant, her heart sinking, hands moving mechanically through the cords of the jig. She saw him turn back to sit down next to Mara. Now she guessed what Mara had already realized. None of them could leave until the music stopped. The jig wound down to its close, and the audience clapped again.
"That's it. Let us go," Orica thought. "It's time for the interval."
But the prince was still seated and showed no sign of getting up. A servant whispered in his ear, but was waved away impatiently. Prince Otico still expected more. Edgan turned to his troop, looking a little panicked now.
"Quick," he said. "The Maven's Respite."
"I don't know it," Orica said, before anyone could strike up the song. It was a lie, but it was all she could think to do.
"You don't know it?" Edgan said aghast. "Everyone knows it. Lord Lusty and the Swan, then."
"I don't know that one either," said Orica. She was trying to stall them, but she couldn't do it for long. Sooner or later, Edgan would think of a piece that could be played without a lute.
"The prince wants another song,"
Edgan said, his voice quiet and strangled, his eyes boring daggers into Orica's skull.
"What do you know?"
And then it hit her, a thought so wild and right that she could do nothing but act on it. It was as if all the convolutions of her life had played out in order to place her here at exactly this moment.
"I have a song for the prince," she said,
and walked to the front of the stage. Edgan goggled at her, aghast. But the whole audience had seen her intention, and he couldn't send her back without embarrassment. All he could do was move aside, with a sickly grin, and pretend this was planned.
"You'd better know what you're doing," he said through gritted teeth.
Then Orica was alone at the front of the stage, with only her lute between her and Prince Otico, and 100 dignitaries behind him. Some of them, Ossians and Crodans mostly, murmured at the gall of a sard presenting herself so brazenly to the prince. But she only thought of one man as she played the introductory arpeggio, and her heart swelled as the music found her. Her voice carried across the hall, husky and haunting, taking all her worry and fear with it. "The king stood at his window in his castle on the shore. His family were sleeping, his foes were no more. As he looked o'er the sea, he heard knuckles on the door. 'Twas his seer, white as a ghost. 'Sire, please beware, for a storm does draw near, that will tear down your walls and take all you hold dear.' But the king laughed and knew he had nothing to fear, and he turned his old eyes to the coast." The murmuring had died away. Her voice always had the power to surprise a crowd to silence. Even the prince looked up at her with something like awe.
"He said, 'I see no clouds, and the waves are not high. Your omens mislead you, your bones fall awry.' But the seer said, 'Sire, not all storms come from the sky. There are depths to which you cannot see. The tide is returning and coming right soon. It brings with it those you have sent to their doom. There's a wolf in the waves who yet howls from its tomb, and the fallen keep long memory.'"
She saw suspicion dawning on him now, the sense that something was wrong. This tune wasn't harmless like the others. His face fell slowly and hardened, and Orica felt nothing but triumph at the sight.
"Then the king said, 'You lie, for this is my land, passed on to me by fate's bloodied right hand.' 'But, sire,' said the seer, 'though you think you command, your rule is but fleeting here. There are elder things yet than the god you obey, and none may lay claim to this soil, try you may. For this land will be here after you pass away, and its children will still persevere.'"
Prince Otico's face was a picture of sullen anger. He knew he was being defied, perhaps laughed at, but he didn't understand how or why, and that made it worse. Many in the audience looked appalled, while others listened happily, their command of Ossian too weak to read between the lines. Orica raised her eyes and found Harrod in the audience. Even at this distance, she saw his eyes sparkling with tears. his face slack with admiration and fear for her.
"This is for you, my love," she thought.
Said the king, "For this heresy I'll see you burn. I say destiny's charge is not easy to turn." But the seer shook his head. "Sire, you have much to learn, for the Erds said the same in their day." Now the king stands at his window and watches the sea, and he knows that his castle's no sanctuary, as he waits for the truth of the seer's prophecy and the storm that will sweep him away. As the final chord rang out into silence, she felt herself blissfully empty. After so long, her song was complete, and it was perfect. Let them do as they would with her now. Her music had been heard. Scattered applause faltered and died in the audience as the prince glared up at her. Edgan squirmed in an agony of exquisite humiliation, desperate to salvage the moment, not knowing how. Orica stood alone, the focus of it all, and held her head high. "I have heard enough Ossian music," said the prince at last, and stalked out of the hall. His attendants hurried after him. "Honoured guests," cried a servant, "please make your way to your assigned rooms for dinner, which will be served shortly." The tension broke, and the audience all began to talk at once, rustling and gossiping and scraping chairs as they got to their feet and began flowing towards the exits. Orica walked past her stunned fellows to the back of the stage, her heart hammering, and returned her lute to its case. She didn't dare look over her shoulder, afraid that some agent of the Iron Hand was already making their way to the stage to arrest her. If she didn't look, she might stay beneath their notice for long enough to leave the hall. A hand fell on her shoulder before she could pick up the case.
"What was that?" Edgan hissed. "What in Joha's name did you do, you little sad bitch?"
The hate in that word was like ice down Orica's back. Edgan had never shown any signs of prejudice against her race, but how quickly the veil fell now she'd displeased him. She pushed his hand off her shoulder and turned, such fury in her gaze that he took a step back, surprised by the force of it. Elbowing her way past him, she headed for the small door behind the stage. Edgan followed her.
"Where do you think you're going?"
he demanded in an angry whisper. "Next performance is Third Bella Dark, yes?" Orica said over her shoulder. "I am taking a break." She left him fuming. Belatedly, she realized that she'd forgotten her lute in her agitation, but she dared not turn back for it now. She couldn't risk being detained. There was too much at stake. A Croden guard at the door watched her approach, clearly wondering if he should stop her. Everyone in the hall had seen her performance. Everyone had witnessed the prince's bristling displeasure. But he probably didn't know enough Ossian to understand her song, and he had no orders to detain her. When it came to it, he stood out of her way. She sighed with relief as the door closed behind her. She was in a narrow service corridor used mainly by servants, and there was nobody in sight, for the staff were all busy herding guests to their various feasts. She'd have to hurry. First Bella Dark couldn't be far off now, and she had some way to go to reach the others. She set off quickly, keen to put some distance between her and the hall before any watchmen should hear of what she'd done and come looking. She had her excuses ready in case anyone questioned her, and the best route to the sewers was fixed in her mind, along with several alternatives besides. Her memory had been sharpened by years of training. It had to be good to remember her arsenal of music.
"My lute," she thought.
It had been her companion for many years, and she was sad to leave it behind. But sards didn't place much value on objects, for they travelled light, and possessions could easily be stolen and lost. Feelings were all that counted. An instrument could be replaced. Her companions' lives couldn't. She began to tremble as she walked. The recklessness of what she'd done was beginning to sink in. She hadn't felt the fear on stage, but it came now, and with it the cold terror of discovery. She found no thrill in trespassing. Her bravery was confined to her art.
"Prin, ragged mama, lend me your gift of disguise. Let me go unseen."
But no sooner had she sent her prayer than she heard hurrying footsteps behind her. She turned a corner, hoping to evade whoever it was, but the footsteps kept coming at a pace just short of a run. She'd have to run too if she wanted to avoid them, and that would damn her. At least Harrod could save the others now. At least there was that.
You!
She stopped. It was Edgan. He stood at the corner, breathing hard, his hair falling in disarray around his face.
I'm not finished with you, he told her.
I've nothing to say to you, Edgan, she replied, though the look on his face made her afraid. He wasn't an intimidating man, being of no great size, but alone with his anger in an empty corridor, Orica found him intimidating enough.
"Well, I've something to say to you," he told her, advancing. "And your paymaster, Errol."
Her brow creased as she backed away.
"I don't know who that is." "Lying slut!" he spat. "Who else would profit from my humiliation but my rival? Did he make my lutist ill, I wonder?"
She had no idea who he was talking about, but she'd stopped listening anyway, his words becoming a jumble in the rolling wave of fear that swept her up. He seized her wrist, and she wanted to slap him, but didn't dare in case it made things worse.
"Do you know what you've done to me with that little ditty of yours? To my reputation?"
His face was close to hers now. She could smell his breath, scented with lavender and fury.
"It's lucky the Prince's Ossian isn't up to much. If he'd been able to decipher all your little word plays, we'd both be hanged already."
"Let me go," was all she could think of to say. It came out weak and sounded pathetic. A few moments ago she'd dominated an entire room, but he'd robbed her of that in an instant.
"Let you go?" he cried. "No, you're coming with me. You can explain yourself to the Master of Revels. I'll be God's damned if I'll be ruined over one gold-digging, green-eyed ghetto whore."
She tried to pull away, but he dragged her roughly after him.
"Unhand that lady," said a stern voice.
"Harrod!"
She could have wept with joy.
"I told you to unhand her," Harrod said when Edgan hesitated.
He began walking towards them.
"Otherwise you'll deal with me."
Edgan was transformed, becoming peevish and whiny in the presence of a bigger man.
"You don't understand. She's an impostor sent to ruin me."
"I understand that you still have not released her, and I will not ask a third time."
Edgan dropped her arm as if it were a burning log. Harrod loomed over him, chillingly impassive, a wall of threat.
"It would be best if you made yourself scarce," he advised, "before I bring dishonour on us both by beating you soundly."
Edgan hesitated, caught between his desire for revenge and his fear of Harrod. Harrod flared his nostrils slightly. Edgan jumped as if he'd been shouted at and fled up the corridor. The instant he turned the corner, Orica threw herself into Harrod's arms, clutching tight to him. Only the fast thump of his heart revealed the anger and worry he'd kept from his face.
"Did he hurt you, milady?"
"No," she said. "Thanks to you."
Then she pulled away, eyes wide, remembering their mission.
"We must go, now."
A bell tolled in the heights of Hammerholt, a solitary note reverberating through the corridors, the doleful sound of doom.
"First bell of dark," said Harrod.
"We're too late,"
said Orica in horror. Then, breaking into a run,
"We're too late."
89. Darkness, terror, the icy clutch of black water. Aaron broke the surface with a gasp and hit his head painfully on the cave roof. Dazed and panicked, he flailed about with his hands, trying to make sense of the space around him. His knuckles burned as he skinned them on the rough rock. His palms found stone, splashed into water.
"Hoi!" he shouted. "Hoi!" "Aaron!"
It was Cade somewhere nearby. Aaron could hear Grubb gasping and grunting off to his left.
"Are we all here?"
"Aye," said Vika, "and Ruck too."
"I can't see,"
Fenn cried.
"I know,"
said Aaron, trying to keep calm.
"Nor can I."
The water was up under his chin, and the top of his head bumped against stone again. The water level was rising so fast
that they'd resurfaced into a sandwich of air mere inches thick. His swords were dragging him down. He carried Garrick's as well as his own, but he couldn't let them go without giving up all they'd come for. Kicking his feet, he fought against their weight as the water tried to drag him down. Something hard and heavy nudged his shoulder, and his hand found the side of the upturned boat. It had become wedged against the ceiling, pressed upwards by the water, and it didn't move when he pushed it. A memory flared in his mind of a bright hot day in the classroom back in Shoal Point. Aaron had been struggling to concentrate as his tutor droned on about mathematics and how to calculate volume. The master had demonstrated how you could put an upturned glass of tumbler in a beaker of water and it would remain empty. Aaron had marvelled at that. How could the glass stay empty even though it was underwater? "Because it wasn't empty," said the master. "It was full of air."
"The boat!" Aaron cried. "Get under the boat! There's air underneath!"
"Where are you?" Kate called. "Swim to my voice!" There was bumping, gasping and splashing in the dark. Ruck barked right by his ear and paddled past. "Everyone found it? Everyone found the boat?" Aaron called, but if there was any reply he couldn't hear it now. The water was around his ears, and he had to tilt his head right back to find air. Taking as big a breath as he could, he closed his eyes and ducked under the water, feeling his way under the gunwale and into the forest of kicking legs beyond. Someone booted him in the chest as he ascended, but he hardly felt it in the flurry. He came up and hit his head hard on one of the bench seats. Blindly, he hooked his arm around it. His relief at being able to breathe outweighed the pain.
"Help me with Ruck," Vika pleaded.
The wet animal smell that engulfed him could have been her hound or her cloak of furs.
"Where is she?"
Vika pushed Ruck against his body. Paws scrabbled at him as Aaron and Vika each got an arm under her.
"Peace, Ruck. Do not struggle so," said Vika.
Ruck did as she was told and allowed herself to be held above water. Cade was whimpering close by.
"I don't want to die. I don't want to die."
"We're not going to die," Aaron told him.
Reassuring him was a reflex.
"Fen?"
"I'm here,"
she said quietly.
"Grub?"
Grub swore in skull.
"He's here," said Cade, with a burst of shrill hysterical laughter.
"Cade,"
said Aaron, then more sharply.
"Cade, we're not going to die."
Cade's laughter subsided to a muted sniffle.
"They'll come for us," said Aaron.
No one said anything to that. The boat bumped and scraped against the roof of the cavern. Water sloshed around their shoulders.
"Do you know the story of Red Asp, the Desert Dawn Warden?" Cade began.
"We need to save our breath," Aaron said gently. They all hushed after that, and only their breathing told of the private terrors they suffered as they waited in the dark. Aaron became detached from the beat of time, floating in a black eternity. The cold crept deeper into his body, overwhelming the warm glow of Vika's potion, slowing his thoughts. Webs of blue, green, and red flashed before his light-starved eyes.
"They'll come for us," he told himself as his teeth began to chatter. "They will, they will."
After a while, the cold began to recede, and he started to feel drowsy. Then suddenly he was underwater. The shock of it jolted him awake, sent him spluttering back up to the surface, Ruck scrabbling against him. He secured them both again, arm around the bench overhead, but no sooner had he done so than he felt sleep coming again, pressing in at the edges of his eye sockets. His head ached, and the sound of breathing around him had turned deep and slow, as if everyone was on the edge of slumber.
"Crows," Grub slurred. "Why Grub hear crows?"
"What crows?"
Aaron mumbled thickly. He was surprised to find his own voice was slurred too. Grub didn't answer. Instead, there was a quiet, slithering splash.
"Grub?"
It was hard for Aaron to concentrate. He'd already forgotten what he'd meant to ask. Something about crows? Next to him, Cade gave a drowsy snort.
"Grub?"
said Fen from the far end of the boat. He heard more splashing as she felt around.
Grub!" she cried. "He's gone! Grub's gone!" It took a moment for the news to penetrate the fog in Aaron's head. When it did, it threw him back to wakefulness. He pushed Ruck towards Vika, filled his lungs as best he could, and plunged under the water. He heard someone cry out, telling him not to do it, their voice muffled by the roar of blood in his ears. But all he knew was that Grub was sinking into the abyss, and he refused to let that happen. With one powerful stroke, he propelled himself down. His next stroke was leaden, muscles aching. The next was like pulling through treacle. His weakness terrified him, but he still reached outwards with his hands, casting his arms wide, trusting to luck to make contact with Grub. No good. He pushed down again, head buzzing, chest aching. The breath he'd taken had lasted a pitifully short time. He cast out again, waving blindly at the water, and his wrist hit flesh. Desperately, he snatched at Grub, found an arm, seized it. Now up, up! He hardly had the strength to move himself, let alone the hefty skull, but he forced his dulled and throbbing muscles to move to the engine of his will, and he swam. One stroke, another. Now his lungs were twin balls of fire, and his vision writhed with sparkling worms. In a lash of mad panic, he thought, "Where is the boat?" and realized too late that he had no idea. It could be anywhere above him, and that tiny island of air was no easy target to hit. If he missed, he'd find only the roof of the cave and death. There was a third swimmer in the water with them. He knew it as clearly as if he could see her. The red-eyed child floated in the dark nearby, her hood wafting in the water around her bald head, her gaze fixed on him. One more pull, one more. The water parted, and sweet cold air burst into his lungs in a rush, dousing the blaze in his chest. He reached back with his free hand, numb fingers clenched around Grub's collar, and pulled him up into the darkness and dripping silence. They were not inside the boat. Dizzy, not understanding, Aaron looked about as if he could penetrate the endless dark. His splashes echoed back strangely, telling him the story. There was air here, filling the space all around him, but that was impossible. The water had filled the cave. It could only mean one thing. The water level was dropping, dropping fast. Something pulled at his leg, a force that quickly grew to surround his lower body, gathering strength with every moment. In his mind's eye he saw Sala, cheated of her catch, her arms wrapped round his legs to drag him down to the depths. He gave a shrill cry as the force became irresistible, and he was sucked under again, still holding on to Grub as the water closed over his head. They were dragged into a swirling torrent of invisible currents, tumbling through the thundering dark. Something smacked Aaron's leg, sending him spinning. Grub was ripped from his grasp. He flailed as a light rushed towards him at terrifying speed, and he was disgorged into the air. For one sickening instant he was flying. Then he splashed down onto his side and was shunted helplessly along a stone channel, arms waving in search of a grip. His hand was caught, and he was hauled bodily from the water and dumped onto a path, where he lay gasping like a landed fish, clutching his belly as he coughed and retched. "There's Grub! Catch him!" Orica shouted over the bellow of the water. Aaron, too weak and battered to raise his head, could only listen to the chaos around him, his ribs rising and falling in desperate relief. He heard Grub hauled out and dropped alongside him, heard Orica thump his back until he gagged up water. Harrod hunted along the waterside, snatching up their companions as they tumbled through the doorway. "Is that everyone?" "There's still no sign of Cade." "Cade." "Hold," Harrod cried immediately. "Here he comes. Grab him." Cade's distressed wail as he was belched forth from the doorway brought an exhausted smile from Aaron. If he had breath to scream, he had breath to live. Harrod grabbed him, and Aaron at last let himself believe they were not going to drown.
He heard the slapping of wet paws and a warm tongue slurped across his cheek. He rolled onto his back as Ruck barked in his face. It was hard to ignore a summons like that. Slinging his arm around the hound's neck, Aaron hauled himself up, fighting off a wave of nausea. He was in an ancient vaulted tunnel, cold and rank-smelling, lit by a pair of lanterns resting nearby. The stone path he lay on was above the level of the water, which burst from the doorway to race down the sewer channel in a torrent. Arranged along the path were his companions, all as bedraggled as he. Squatting among them was Harrod, shoulders heaving with effort, his hair plastered to his head and his fine clothes drenched. Orica was kneeling by Vika, helping her to sit up. All safe, thank Joha for that. Fen was curled up next to him, tangled in her bow, which had miraculously stayed on her back. Perhaps half a dozen arrows remained in her quiver. She let out a groan and raised her head.
"Told you they'd come for us," Aaron croaked and gave her a grin.
Fen huffed with laughter.
"I hate you sometimes," she said, meaning the opposite.
90. The Lord's Parlour of Hammerholt was busy with guests. They chattered in clusters, smoked cheroots and played cards and castles, while a musician struck up a jaunty tune on a harpsichord. Mara drifted among them, her wine glass never far from her lips, eyes restless, hunting. It was a narrow chamber with a low ceiling, more intimate than imposing, warmed by a crackling hearth set into one wall. Brass candelabra hung from elaborate ceiling roses along its length. Frescoes softened the fortress's stern design, depicting scenes from Ossian folk tales, which the Crodans must have thought harmless or obscure enough to escape erasure. One showed Huldric and his companion Bumbleweed trudging dejectedly out of the sea after Haldric's ill-fated attempt to woo the Kraken's daughter. It was one of Mara's childhood favourites. The sight gave her a twinge of nostalgic delight. A rousing guffaw drew her attention to the Master of Keys. He was standing with a group of men, trading anecdotes. Mara watched them as she picked at the buffet table, and the taste of wine soured in her mouth. How she loathed those braying Crodan highborns and the Ossian nobles who aped them. How she hated their clubs and societies that divided the world into who was in and who was out. Every joke and gesture were part of a secret code she wasn't privy to, meant to exclude anyone who wasn't connected enough, successful enough, male enough. Were they discussing Orica? Possibly. Her exceptional performance in the West Gallery had caused much gossip. What were they saying, then? Mocking her, most likely, or speculating what they'd do to such a beauty, given half a chance. She felt herself becoming angry on Orica's behalf. Orica's song had touched her, and Mara wasn't easily stirred. Her daring and quick thinking might have saved the lives of their companions down below. She deserved admiration, not belittlement. But Orica was a woman and a sard, and it wasn't in the nature of men like these to admire women, except as objects of desire. "Peace, Mara," she told herself,